Hello and welcome back to the Deep Dive. I'm Alex Johnson, and I'm ready to guide you through what has been, well, a truly packed week of federal news today.
And I'm Sam Kennedy, here to help us unravel some of the intricate connections and the broader implications across this whole landscape of information. Today, we're embarking on a deep dive into the federal news update for Friday, September 5th, 2025.
Right. And our mission for this deep dive really is to give you a truly thorough and comprehensive look at, well, pretty much every significant action and activity of the U.S. federal government since the beginning of September 3rd, 2025.
Yeah, we're going beyond just the headlines here. We want to dissect the granular details, really understand both the immediate impact and, you know, the far-reaching implications of each move for you, for the nation, and honestly for the world.
What's particularly striking about this past week, I think, is how these developments aren't really isolated incidents.
Exactly. They represent a dynamic interplay that's actively shaping our governance, our economy, our foreign policy.
We're seeing a very assertive executive branch pushing its agenda quite hard.
Right. Well, the judiciary is definitely stepping in as a constitutional check. And then you've got Congress grappling with these really pressing fiscal deadlines, all amidst, you know, deep ideological divides.
Our goal today is to help you connect those dots, see the larger patterns that are emerging from all this activity.
So let's try to unpack this considerable body of information. Where should we start? Maybe with the executive branch and its ambitious agenda.
Sounds good. Let's dive into that first.
Yep.
Okay, first up, we're seeing a highly concentrated effort by the Trump administration to implement its policy agenda. And a lot of this is happening through presidential directives, through agency-level regulatory changes.
Right, often effectively bypassing the traditional legislative process, which is interesting in itself.
Yeah, and a core component of this whole approach is what they're explicitly calling the deconstruction of the administrative state.
And that phrase, deconstruction, it's pretty loaded. It suggests something more than just budget cuts.
Exactly. It really seems to be a systematic strategy to reduce the size, the scope, and maybe most importantly, the independent influence of the federal bureaucracy.
And even its affiliated civil society partners, right?
Yep.
They seem to be targeting perceived institutional or ideological opposition.
Okay, let's look at the specifics. On September 3rd, Executive Order 14343, titled Further Exclusions from the Federal Labor Management Relations Program, was officially published in the Federal Register. Now, it was signed back on August 28th, but its public release this week makes it a key development we need to cover.
And what's really critical here is how this order expands on previous directives. Specifically, it excludes additional subdivisions of federal agencies, though they aren't named yet, from collective bargaining rights.
The rights and protections that Chapter 71 of Title V U.S. Code usually provides.
Exactly. And the administration's justification centers on national security. They argue the primary function of these subdivisions involves intelligence, counterintelligence, investigative, or national security work.
And that standard labor management rules would be, what, inconsistent with national security requirements?
That's the language they used, yes. Inconsistent with national security requirements and considerations.
Okay, so let's break that down. For federal employees and really for you, the taxpayer, what's the practical impact here? This isn't just a minor adjustment, is it?
No, not at all. It amends a really foundational directive from 1979, Executive Order 12171. So it effectively curtails collective bargaining rights for a potentially growing segment of the federal workforce.
Which shifts their employment terms more directly under executive control rather than through negotiated agreements.
Precisely. And if you step back and look at the bigger picture, this move aligns perfectly with a broader administrative goal.
Mm-hmm.
Increasing direct presidential control over the civil service.
And diminishing the influence of public sector unions, which this administration often sees as obstacles.
Right. Obstacles to rapid policy implementation. By broadly expanding the definition of what counts as national security work, the order gives them a powerful mechanism to weaken the institutional power of federal employees.
Making the civil service more susceptible to direct political direction.
Exactly. And it really raises a critical question, you know, about that delicate balance between executive authority and the long-held independence of the civil service, particularly concerning the rights of those who serve the public without partisan alignment.
Okay, shifting gears slightly but staying within this theme, we've also seen an executive order aimed squarely at the Department of Education.
Yes, a very direct one. It directs the Secretary of Education to take all necessary steps to facilitate the closure of the Department of Education.
Closure. That's a significant move, to say the least. Huge implications.
Absolutely huge. And coupled with that closure directive, there's a strict fiscal mandate. The order specifically states that any remaining federal education funds must not support diversity, equity, and inclusion, or similar programs promoting what it calls gender ideology.
Right, so that's a clear signal. This directive is really a cornerstone of the administration's social agenda, isn't it? Targeting a department often criticized by conservatives.
And signaling a very clear ideological shift away from these types of social policies within federal funding streams.
So the impact here, it seems really twofold. First, it kicks off this incredibly complex, politically charged process of potentially dismantling a major federal agency,
which has massive implications for how education policy is shaped and funded across the entire country. For you, for your kids.
And second, it sends an immediate, powerful signal, not just within education, but across all federal agencies, state and local governments, even private grant recipients.
The message is clear. DEI initiatives are officially disfavored.
Which could jeopardize existing programs and certainly future access to federal funding for anything related to DEI.
Exactly. This creates a significant chilling effect that extends far beyond the Department of Education itself. It essentially warns institutions and organizations that continuing such programs could jeopardize access to vital federal funding,
forcing them to reconsider priorities or risk financial penalties.
It leaves us wondering how this might fundamentally reshape educational priorities and cultural policy nationwide, and what impact it will ultimately have on the diversity of educational environments and opportunities available to you and your family.
And this effort to shrink the federal footprint doesn't stop with just specific departments like education.
No, we're also seeing specific government entities targeted for reduction or even elimination.
Right. An executive order identified 7 such entities. One example given was the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars,
which is a federally chartered institution known for independent research and dialogue, often providing bipartisan insights. So targeting it sends a message too.
Definitely. And concurrently, there was a presidential memorandum announcing a policy to stop funding NGOs that undermine the national interest.
Okay. And that directs all executive departments and agencies to review their funding for non-governmental organizations.
And to align future funding decisions with the interests of the United States.
So that extends the administration's ideological control beyond direct government entities, reaching into that vast network of NGOs that often partner with federal programs domestically and internationally.
So what's the practical impact here? For you, maybe, if you interact with these NGOs or for the organizations themselves, that phrase, undermining the national interest, it sounds quite vague.
It is very vague. And that vagueness leaves broad discretion to agencies to potentially defund organizations engaged in advocacy or service delivery that might simply be critical of or not perfectly aligned with the administration's current policies.
That could certainly lead to a significant chilling effect on independent civil society and, you know, critical discourse.
Precisely. This has potentially profound implications for civil society organizations, both here and abroad, that rely heavily on government grants. It raises a really critical consideration about the independence of NGOs and their role in a functioning democracy if funding becomes tied to perceived ideological alignment.
Yeah, it risks limiting the range of diverse voices and maybe even essential services that receive federal support. Could reshape the whole landscape of public advocacy and social services. Okay. Let's turn our attention now to immigration. The administration seems to be initiating a major overhaul of the legal immigration system.
Yeah, and this isn't just about physical border security like a wall. It's about constructing what some are calling a digital wall.
A digital wall. What does that entail?
It's designed to create a high-friction, high-surveillance environment for non-citizens. These policies, when you look at them together, seem aimed at deterring overstays and monitoring behavior through a combination of, well, administrative hurdles, and advanced technology.
Okay, let's break that down. On the visa front, the Department of State is moving forward with this visa bond pilot program.
Right, that was established by a temporary final rule back in August.
And it specifically targets B1, B2 business and tourist visa applicants from countries with high overstay rates.
Correct, requiring them to post bonds, significant bonds, $5,000, $10,000, even $15,000, just as a condition of entry. Malawi and Zambia are the first countries included in this pilot.
So a critical aspect here is how this policy basically financializes immigration risk.
Exactly. It places a significant economic burden on visitors from these designated countries, effectively making entry a privilege tied to a substantial financial guarantee against overstaying.
And at the same time, the Department of Homeland Security is advancing a major regulatory change.
Yes, one that would end duration of statuses for F, academic student, J, exchange visitor, and I, foreign media, non-immigrants.
Meaning, instead of being admitted for the entire length of their program, they'd get fixed admission periods.
Right. And then they would need to apply for extensions to stay legally.
Okay, a proposed rule for this was published August 28th, and the public comment period ends September 29th. If this gets finalized, it fundamentally alters how these individuals maintain their legal presence. What's the real-world consequence? For international students, scholars, and maybe for you, if you interact with them or benefit from their work.
Well, it introduces a new, recurring bureaucratic hurdle for hundreds of thousands of people. They need to navigate complex application processes for extensions of stay, adding significant uncertainty and administrative burden.
Could lead to delays, stress, maybe even forced departures if they can't navigate the system.
Absolutely. And looking at the wider context, the long-term implication is a potential decline in the attractiveness of the United States as a destination for global talent, students, tourists.
Which could negatively affect U.S. innovation, higher education, overall economic competitiveness, limiting that inflow of diverse perspectives and expertise our country has historically attracted.
Exactly. It's a potential brain drain issue, too.
And these administrative hurdles, they're being paired with what sounds like a dramatic escalation in the surveillance of non-immigrants.
Yes. DHS has proposed revisions to forms I-17 and I-20 that would massively expand the data collected from schools and students.
How so? What kind of data are we talking about?
Under these proposed changes, schools would have to report more detailed info on their ownership structures, specific programs of study, costs. And for students, the new requirements would include reporting on their guardians, specific graduation dates, sources of funding, instructional modes, even post-completion employment or training.
Wow, that sounds like it creates a comprehensive federal database tracking the financial, familial, professional lives of foreign students.
It does. It centralizes an unprecedented amount of personal information.
And the data collection doesn't stop there, apparently. The administration also decided to move forward with a contract.
Yes, a contract to provide U.S. immigration agents with access to sophisticated hacking tools from Paragon Solutions, an Israeli-founded company.
And these tools reportedly can hack into virtually any mobile phone, even encrypted ones.
That's the report, offering unprecedented access to individuals' private digital lives.
That development, it obviously raises profound privacy and civil liberties concerns, especially for non-citizens within the U.S.
Definitely. It implies the government could gain deeply intrusive access to personal communications and data, possibly without clear transparency or robust due process.
And the broader implication seems to be an increasing reliance on technology for highly intrusive monitoring of targeted individuals.
Which raises critical questions about the appropriate extent of government surveillance and its potential for abuse. We're left pondering that balance between national security and privacy in the digital age. And where is the line drawn for all citizens, not just non-immigrants? These technologies could set far-reaching precedents.
All right, let's shift now to national security. The administration appears to be actively working to reshape the leadership and priorities of the intelligence apparatus.
Yes, and this effort seems driven by a deep-seated distrust of the existing establishment. We're seeing public accusations against former officials and some politically charged decisions regarding military infrastructure.
Like on September 3rd, the Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, gave a keynote speech at the National Conservatism Conference.
Right. And in her remarks, she articulated a central mission for her office, to provide the president with intelligence free from politicization.
Which sounds reasonable on its face, but the context matters here.
It absolutely does. You have to note the weight of her accusations in that same speech. She leveled very serious allegations against former intelligence community leaders.
It's specifically naming James Clapper and John Brennan.
Yes, alleging they knowingly manufactured a false intelligence document to undermine the first Trump administration. She went further, claiming leaders in the IC and the FBI used false information to get FISA warrants to illegally spy on American citizens.
Those are incredibly serious claims, especially coming publicly from a sitting DNI. They imply deep-seated institutional corruption.
They really do, and potentially inflammatory claims. So what's the practical impact of that kind of rhetoric for the intelligence community itself?
Well, By framing the issue as one of conspirators and traitors to the Constitution working within the government, the DNI has pretty much set the stage for a deeply confrontational relationship with career intelligence officials.
Precisely. It signals a commitment to internal purges, maybe reforms aimed primarily at ensuring ideological alignment with the White House rather than just objective analysis.
Could that lead to a significant brain drain, experienced professionals leaving, or just a chilling effect on dissenting opinions?
Both are real risks. It creates a critical consideration about the independence and integrity of intelligence gathering itself, and how public trust in these vital institutions might be profoundly affected if the perception of pervasive politicization becomes widespread.
Also on September 3rd, President Trump made his first public appearance in about a week.
Yes, to announce a significant reversal regarding U.S. Space Command headquarters.
Right. It had been temporarily located in Colorado Springs, Colorado, but now it will be permanently established in Huntsville, Alabama.
Now, the administration presents this as a strategic decision based on logistical advantages and such.
But it's widely viewed through a political lens, isn't it?
It is. This decision clearly rewards a Republican stronghold in Alabama, which is home to key congressional allies, while simultaneously reversing a decision that would have benefited Colorado, a state that's trended more Democratic.
So the move strongly suggests political considerations are taking precedence over traditional military basing criteria,
which are typically meant to be strategic, logistical, and cost-benefit driven, ideally apolitical.
So for you, the listener, and for the broader military community, what's the practical impact? Injecting partisan considerations into what's normally a long-term, apolitical military basing decision.
Well, it could impact resource allocation, the morale of personnel, maybe even the efficiency of operations, if strategic factors truly become secondary.
And looking wider, this implies a potential erosion of those apolitical norms in military affairs,
which could indeed impact readiness and morale, all for the sake of political patronage. It begs a question. How much should military decisions, ideally based on objective strategic needs, be influenced by partisan politics?
Such a precedent could have really profound long-term effects on the integrity and effectiveness of our national defense. Okay, let's turn to technology now. The administration has launched a pretty high-profile initiative focused on artificial intelligence.
Right, with a particular emphasis on education and youth engagement. And this is coupled with some significant new legislation aimed at online safety.
So on September 4th, First Lady Melania Trump hosted the second meeting of the White House Task Force on Artificial Intelligence Education.
And this task force was set up by an executive order back in April, specifically focusing on advancing artificial intelligence education for American youth.
The First Lady seems to be the public face of this initiative.
She really has become that, framing the need for AI education in, well, relatable, almost parental terms. She stated, "During this primitive stage, it is our duty to treat AI as we would our own children, empowering, but with watchful guidance."
Interesting framing. And the initiative's core focus is promoting AI literacy in K-12 education.
Yes, through public-private partnerships. They announced over 135 pledges of support from industry at that meeting.
And a key component is the Presidential AI Challenge.
Right, a national competition for K-12 students and educators launched in late August. It invites participants to develop AI-powered solutions to problems in their local communities,
encouraging hands-on creativity and practical application of AI concepts.
Exactly. The key insight here is that this program is designed to foster both interest and basic competency in AI among young people. It directly aligns with the administration's stated goal of maintaining U.S. global dominance in AI.
So for you, this means a direct federal push into shaping the future workforce and technological literacy. It could impact the school curricula your kids or grandkids encounter.
Potentially, yes.
Now, beyond education, the administration is also overseeing the implementation of a major new law, the Take IT Down Act.
Right, the tools to address known exploitation by immobilizing technological deepfakes on websites and networks Act. Quite a mouthful.
It is. This was a bipartisan law signed by President Trump back on May 19th.
And this act criminalizes the non-consensual publication of intimate images. Critically, it includes AI-generated deepfakes.
And it establishes a mandatory notice and takedown process for online platforms.
Yes. Under the new rules, covered platforms are now required to remove such content within 48 hours of receiving a valid request from a victim. The Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, is tasked with enforcement.
So this creates significant new obligations and legal liabilities for online platforms, fundamentally changing how they manage user-generated content in this area.
It does. It's a major federal intervention into online content moderation.
Championed by the First Lady as part of her BE Best initiative. So for you, this aims to enhance online safety and provide more immediate recourse against harmful content, addressing a growing and, frankly, increasingly sophisticated problem in the digital age.
A necessary step, many would argue, given the rise of deepfake technology.
Okay, let's pivot now sharply to the economy, which is, well, undoubtedly facing a period of significant uncertainty and maybe growing risk.
Yeah, the convergence of deteriorating labor market data, the persistent negative effects of the administration's aggressive trade policies, and the resulting pressure on the Federal Reserve to change its monetary policy. Mm. It's created a truly precarious economic environment. #TagTagTakeA. The August 2025 jobs report and its fallout.
The August 2025 Employment Situation Report, released by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the BLS, on September 5th, it provided the clearest signal yet that the U.S. labor market is stalling.
The report's weak headline numbers, combined with those significant downward revisions, painted a picture of an economy rapidly losing momentum.
Specifically, the BLS reported the economy added just 22,000 non-farm payroll jobs in August.
A mere 22,000. That figure is far below the consensus forecast, which was somewhere around 75,000 to 80,000 jobs.
And the unemployment rate also ticked up to 4.3%. That's its highest level since late 2021. A clear weakening sign.
But perhaps even more concerning than the weak August numbers were those substantial revisions to prior month's data.
Right. The report revealed the economy actually lost 13,000 jobs in June. That's a sharp downward revision from the modest gain they previously reported.
And that marks the first month of net job losses since the height of the COVID-19 pandemic back in December 2020.
So with these revisions, the average monthly job gain over the past 3 months has fallen to just 29,000.
Which is a pace barely sufficient to keep up with population growth and a dramatic deceleration from earlier in the year. The key takeaway here is a rapidly cooling labor market that is significantly weaker than we previously understood.
So for you, the listener, what's the practical impact of this downward trend? It really paints a picture of an economy losing steam fast.
Suggesting the underlying strength of the job market might be far more fragile than many realized. This kind of slowdown affects everything from consumer confidence to business investment decisions.
Potentially impacting your job security, the value of your investments, maybe even your ability to find new work if you're looking.
And if you dive into the underlying details of the report, it revealed a labor market with a really narrow base of growth.
Meaning?
Well, the only significant job gains happened in healthcare and social assistance. Those sectors collectively added 47,000 positions.
But that growth is largely driven by long-term demographic demand, right? An aging population.
Exactly. Suggesting that where growth is occurring, it's highly concentrated and not broadly distributed across the economy.
Meanwhile, almost all other major sectors either stalled or actually shed jobs.
Right. Manufacturing, which has been a key focus of the administration's industrial policy, lost 12,000 jobs.
Continuing a downward trend, I think the sector's lost 78,000 jobs over the past year.
That's correct. Which directly contradicts the stated goal of boosting domestic industry. A significant policy disconnect there.
And other sectors impacted by tariffs and general economic uncertainty also showed weakness.
Pronounced weakness. Wholesale trade lost 12,000 positions. Construction shed 7,000. And notably, the federal government itself.
Under pressure from the administration's own directives to shrink the bureaucracy.
Lost 15,000 jobs in August. And has cut nearly 100,000 positions since January.
Wow. So if you connect those dots, the concentration of job losses in sectors sensitive to trade policy and interest rates, plus these politically driven cuts in government employment.
It clearly underscores the direct impact of administration policies on the labor market slowdown. It looks like a very targeted and policy-driven economic contraction in many ways.
Now, this weak August report came right after a similarly disappointing July report, which also had those large downward revisions.
And in response to the July data, President Trump took the really unprecedented step of firing the BLS commissioner, Erica McGuntarfer.
Who was a Biden appointee confirmed by the Senate, so not just a political appointee in the usual sense.
Correct. And the president alleged, without providing any evidence, that the jobs data had been manipulated to reflect poorly on his administration.
And to replace McIntarfer, the president nominated E.J. Antoni, an economist from the Conservative Heritage Foundation.
Which clearly signals an attempt to control the narrative around economic data. especially when it's unfavorable.
The firing drew sharp criticism, though, not just from Democrats.
No, from economists across the political spectrum, including William Beach, who was a former BLS commissioner appointed by Trump himself.
What did he say?
He called the firing totally groundless and warned that it sets a dangerous precedent and undermines the statistical mission of the Bureau.
That's a strong statement from a former commissioner appointed by the same president. It raises serious questions about the integrity and independence of crucial government data,
which is supposed to be objective and nonpartisan. This action isn't just about one jobs report. It feels like a direct assault on the impartiality of government statistics.
And when official statistics become politicized, it erodes that fundamental trust needed for markets, businesses, and frankly, individual citizens like you to make informed decisions.
It injects dangerous uncertainty into the very bedrock of our economy. It begs the question, if you can't trust the numbers, how can sound policy be made? How can effective financial decisions be taken? This is crucial for you to make informed choices and for overall economic stability.
Okay, so given this sharp deterioration in the labor market, the Federal Reserve is now facing pretty clear evidence of a cooling economy.
Evidence that many believe warrants an interest rate cut. The central bank is under immense pressure to act, and the market is certainly anticipating it.
Following the release of that August jobs report, financial markets pretty much solidified their expectations that the Fed will cut its benchmark interest rate at its upcoming meeting.
Right. The meeting is September 16th and 17th. This would be the first rate adjustment since December 2024.
And futures markets are pricing in what, a 99% probability of at least a quarter point cut?
Yes, a 0.25% cut seems almost certain, according to the markets. And many investors are now anticipating a series of cuts through the end of the year, possibly bringing the federal funds rate down to a range of 3.5% to 3.75% by December.
Fed Chair Jerome Powell had already kind of signaled a more dovish turn in his speech at Jackson Hole in late August.
He had. He noted that a weaker labor market might indeed warrant rate cuts. So the dismal August report seems like the final piece of evidence needed to prompt the Federal Open Market Committee, the FOMC, to act.
And for you, the listener, this could mean changes in everything from mortgage rates to the cost of borrowing for cars or credit cards, potentially making big purchases more affordable or maybe affecting your savings yield.
Indeed. But it also means the Fed is navigating this immense political pressure from an administration that is actively undermining the credibility of the very data the Fed relies on.
That creates a deeply challenging environment for independent monetary policy. The foundational information needed for sound decision-making is being questioned from the highest levels.
It really leaves us pondering how truly independent the Fed can remain in such a politicized economic environment, and what effect that might have on its effectiveness in stabilizing the economy, especially when its own credibility is being challenged. #C, the tariff regime and global trade uncertainty.
Now, a significant contributing factor to this economic slowdown is undoubtedly the administration's aggressive and broad-based tariff policy.
Yes. The uncertainty and the increased costs generated by these trade levies are now being cited by a wide array of analysts, international bodies, as a primary cause of the decline in manufacturing, investment, and hiring.
For example, there was a September 1st global trade update from the UN Conference on Trade and Development, UNCTAD.
Right. And UNCTAD stated that trade policy uncertainty, largely driven by U.S. actions, has soared to record levels and become a major source of global instability.
That's strong language from a UN body.
It is. The report details how these sudden shifts in tariffs disrupt supply chains, raise costs for businesses, discourage investment, and fuel market volatility. These aren't minor inconveniences. They're fundamental disruptions to global commerce and economic planning.
And economists and industry analysts are directly linking the job losses in U.S. manufacturing and wholesale trade to the tangible impact of these tariffs.
Reducing profit margins, slowing job creation. So the very policy intended to protect and boost domestic industry is now widely seen as a primary cause of its contraction.
So for you, this isn't just abstract policy. It means potentially higher prices at the store, uncertainty in sectors tied to global trade, and a general dampening effect on broader economic opportunities and job stability.
Absolutely. And here's how the story takes that fascinating legal turn we mentioned earlier. Yeah. The very legal foundation of the administration's tariff regime is under serious threat.
Okay, remind us of the ruling.
In a 7-4 ruling, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit found that President Trump had overstepped his presidential powers when he invoked the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, IEEPA, from 1977.
Which he used to justify many of his reciprocal tariffs.
Exactly. The court stated quite clearly that while IEPA grants the president significant authority in a declared national emergency,
none of these actions explicitly include the power to impose tariffs, duties, or the like, or the power to tax.
Right. That ruling represents a monumental legal challenge. It directly strikes at the heart of the administration's America First trade agenda, questioning the legal basis of its signature economic policy and potentially its entire approach to trade.
And the Trump administration has appealed this to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yes, requesting a swift decision on whether the court will even hear the case by September 10th.
So if the Supreme Court upholds the lower court's ruling,
it could invalidate billions of dollars in tariffs already collected and fundamentally reset the balance of power on trade policy, shifting it back towards the legislative branch.
It really highlights that critical challenge of constitutional division of power in economic policy. Did the executive branch overstep its bounds into areas traditionally reserved for Congress? That's the core question.
A huge question with massive economic implications.
All right, let's shift our focus now to foreign policy. There's a significant evolution underway here, too.
Yes, the administration is formally recategorizing transnational criminal organizations like drug cartels as terrorist groups,
moving the U.S. response away from a purely law enforcement model
and towards a national security and counterterrorism framework, which opens up a whole different set of tools and authorities. #gay counter-narcotics and narco-terrorism doctrine.
Okay, specifically, on September 4th, during a trip to Ecuador, Secretary of State Marco Rubio announced the designation of two powerful Ecuadorian gangs.
Los Chineros and Los Lobos.
Yeah.
They were designated as foreign terrorist organizations, FTOs, and specially designated global terrorists, SDGTs.
And these official designations were published in the Federal Register on September 5th.
Now, the critical aspect here is this isn't just a new label. It's a major policy development. It operationalizes that January 20th, 2025, executive order that established a formal process for designating cartels as terrorist groups.
So by labeling criminal drug trafficking organizations as FTOs, the administration gains access to a new, more potent set of tools.
Exactly. Tools previously reserved for groups like Al-Qaeda or ISIS, state-sponsored terrorism, or ideologically motivated extremists.
As Secretary Rubio put it, the designation brings all sorts of options. What kind of options?
Including the legal authority for direct military action, the freezing of assets under terrorism authorities, and enhanced intelligence sharing for what he called potentially lethal operations.
And the State Department justified this by citing the gang's attacks on public officials, their links to U.S.-designated cartels like Sinaloa,
and their goal of controlling drug routes through terrorizing and inflicting brutal violence on the Ecuadorian people.
So for you, the listener, this signals a really significant shift in how the U.S. combats transnational crime, potentially with far more aggressive military-style tactics.
And the first concrete application of this new war on narco-terrorists doctrine seems to have occurred on September 2nd.
Right. President Trump announced the U.S. military had conducted a kinetic strike against a boat originating from Venezuela in the Southern Caribbean.
A kinetic strike? That's military terminology for using legal force, bombs, or missiles.
And the strike resulted in the deaths of 11 people. The administration alleged they were members of the Venezuelan gang Tren de Aragua,
which was among the first criminal groups designated as an FTO earlier this year under this new policy.
So this marks a clear departure from traditional counter-narcotics operations.
Absolutely. Those typically involve law enforcement interdiction stopping and boarding vessels, making arrests, seizing drugs, not lethal military force from afar.
And looking at the wider context, this event signifies a profound shift.
The move to lethal military force has already raised significant concerns about national sovereignty and the rules of engagement among Latin American nations.
Many of which have a very fraught history with U.S. military intervention in the region, making this particularly sensitive.
It really begs the question about the precedent this sets for military engagement in the fight against crime and the potential for unintended escalations or complex diplomatic fallout. #tag be economic warfare and sanctions.
Okay, beyond the narco-terrorism doctrine, the administration continues to rely heavily on economic sanctions as a primary instrument of foreign policy.
Yes, targeting a wide range of actors, state-sponsored entities, individuals involved in illicit activities. It's a go-to tool.
For example, on September 3rd, the Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control, OFAC, announced sanctions against a Chinese company,
Guangzhou Tianzhu Chemical Co., Ltd., and two of its representatives, Huang Xiaojun and Huang Zhongping.
And they were sanctioned for their role in making and selling synthetic opioids like nitazenes and dangerous cutting agents like xylazine drank,
selling them to buyers here in the United States. This action was taken under Executive Order 14059, which targets the international proliferation of illicit drugs.
What's particularly noteworthy here, though?
OFAC's designation specifically included a Bitcoin address linked to Huang Xiaojun, an address used in an attempt to sell controlled substances to a U.S. buyer.
Ah, so it reflects the evolving nature of financial warfare, targeting illicit crypto transactions.
Exactly. Showing how governments are adapting to track and sanction illicit activities using new technologies.
And this action was coordinated with the Department of Justice.
Yes. The FBI announced federal criminal indictments against the company and individuals for conspiracy to commit drug trafficking. So for you, this highlights the government's multi-agency efforts to combat the influx of dangerous synthetic drugs, tackling both the supply chain and the financial transactions. The State Department has also been active using other levers of power. On September 4th, new visa restrictions were announced.
Targeting who?
Central American nationals found to be working with the Chinese Communist Party to undermine the rule of law in that region.
Okay.
And separately, sanctions were also imposed on Palestinian officials who had requested that the International Criminal Court investigate Israel for alleged war crimes.
These actions followed that controversial move in late August.
Right, when the president used the Impoundment Control Act to try and bypass Congress and cancel $4.9 billion in foreign aid.
Using a pocket recession tool, the first time since 1977.
Yes, though that move was later blocked by a federal judge who ordered the administration to release the funds Congress had approved, underscoring that clash over presidential powers and appropriations we mentioned.
So looking at the wider context, these actions collectively illustrate a very transactional, often punitive approach to diplomacy.
Using access to the U.S. financial system, U.S. visas, U.S. foreign aid, using them all as leverage to compel desired behaviors from foreign actors.
Which raises critical considerations about the effectiveness and, frankly, the ethical implications of such a foreign policy approach, particularly its impact on international relations, humanitarian aid, and the potential for unintended destabilization.
It's a very hard-nosed approach to foreign relations. #C, diplomatic engagements and strategic alliances.
Let's explore some key diplomatic engagements this week. The administration's activities seem to prioritize strengthening relationships with ideologically aligned international partners.
While showing a willingness to let partnerships with other nations fray, often over policy or even personal disagreements.
Okay, good example. On September 3rd, President Trump hosted Polish President Karol Nawrocki at the White House.
A full state visit, including a ceremonial flyover of F-16 and F-35 jets.
And during the visit, President Trump pledged to stand with Warsaw all the way. He explicitly stated he was not considering pulling U.S. troops out of Poland.
Right. And the critical aspect here is how this high-profile engagement underscores the administration's focus on building strong alliances with governments in Europe that share its conservative nationalist worldview.
Poland clearly viewed as a key strategic partner, especially in countering Russian influence.
Exactly. It's a significant geopolitical maneuver. And for you, this speaks to those evolving alliances in a shifting global landscape, where ideological alignment seems to be a key factor in diplomatic prioritization.
But in stark contrast to those strengthened ties with Poland, reports have emerged of a significant deterioration in the relationship with India.
Yes, specifically in the once strong personal relationship between President Trump and Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi.
Tensions have escalated due to the administration imposing tariffs on Indian exports and energy imports.
Right, and the relationship was apparently further strained by a phone call back in June 2025.
What happened on that call?
President Trump allegedly demanded public credit from Prime Minister Modi for his role in de-escalating a military flare-up between India and Pakistan. Indian officials reportedly viewed this claim as exaggerated self-congratulation.
Which highlights a breakdown not just in policy alignment, but maybe in personal diplomatic trust and communication.
It seems so. So what's the practical impact of this deteriorating relationship?
Well, this breakdown really illustrates the inherent risks of a foreign policy that relies so heavily on personal rapport between leaders.
When that personal relationship sours, the strategic partnership itself can begin to erode. It demonstrates the fragility of such an approach when it lacks deeper institutional underpinnings.
And looking at the wider context, this breakdown seems to have created a geopolitical opening.
An opening that U.S. rivals like China and Russia appear to be actively exploiting. India is now seen to be hedging its strategic bets,
seeking to bolster ties with both Russia and China.
Exactly. As evidenced by Prime Minister Modi's participation in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit in early September.
So this raises a critical consideration about the stability of key partnerships and global power dynamics, especially when personal chemistry seems to supersede long-term strategic interests and traditional diplomatic frameworks.
It's a risky way to conduct foreign policy, some would argue. Mm-hmm. Hashtag check AV. The judicial branch as a check on power.
Okay, as we've just heard, the executive branch has been incredibly active, pushing its agenda on multiple fronts.
But in early September, the federal judiciary really emerged as a formidable check on some of the administration's most aggressive policy initiatives.
These cases collectively highlight the judiciary's critical role in enforcing the separation of powers. They seem to be setting the stage for major constitutional showdowns. Hashtag tag A landmark rulings on executive authority. First, in a 2-1 decision, a panel of the 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals issued a preliminary injunction,
blocking the administration from using the Alien Enemies Act of 1798.
A very old law.
To do what? To summarily deport a group of Venezuelan men alleged to be members of that trendy Aragua criminal gang we mentioned earlier.
The administration had argued the gang's activities constituted a predatory incursion on U.S. soil, triggering the president's wartime powers under this seldom-used act.
That was their argument, yes. But writing for the majority, Judge Leslie H. Southwick, a George W. Bush appointee, firmly rejected it.
How so? What was the reasoning?
Judge Southwick ruled that the act's reference to an invasion or predatory incursion applies specifically to military activities directed by a foreign nation, not to illegal immigration or even serious criminal activity by non-state actors.
Okay, so what's the practical impact of that ruling?
It significantly constrains a president's ability to use these archaic national security laws to bypass modern immigration due process.
Affirming that even serious criminal activity isn't legally equivalent to an act of war, which has profound implications for how the government can treat individuals within its borders.
Right, emphasizing the importance of established legal frameworks. Now, the administration is expected to appeal this decision, so it's far from settled. It will likely continue up the judicial ladder.
But it begs the question, what are the true limits of presidential emergency powers, especially when they intersect with established legal processes protecting individual rights?
A crucial question for you, ensuring due process is upheld even in challenging national security situations.
Okay, second ruling. In another highly significant decision, a federal judge found that President Trump had illegally deployed thousands of military troops to Los Angeles back in June 2025.
Yes, and the judge's order, which is set to take effect September 12th, specifically bars the Pentagon from using National Guard members and Marines to perform domestic police functions.
Things like making arrests or crowd control.
Exactly. This ruling was a clear victory for California Governor Gavin Newsom, who had sued the administration,
arguing the deployment violated the Posse Comitatus Act of 1878.
Right, the act that explicitly prohibits using the U.S. military for domestic law enforcement. The judge's order delivered a strong rebuke, condemning the president's apparent goal of creating a national police force with the president as its chief.
That's powerful language from a judge. A strong judicial pushback against a highly unusual and constitutionally sensitive executive action.
It really is. This decision reinforces that long-standing fundamental principle of American civil-military relations, the clear separation of armed forces from domestic policing.
So for you, the listener, this serves as a powerful legal barrier against presidential attempts to use the military to quell domestic unrest, safeguarding a core tenet of our democracy.
Ensuring military force isn't used against citizens for domestic law enforcement.
And third, we touched on this earlier regarding the economy, but let's look at the full judicial picture now. That major blow to the administration's economic policy from the D.C. Circuit Court.
Right. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit ruled 7-4 that the president overstepped his authority when he used the IEPA, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act of 1977, to impose those sweeping tariffs against numerous countries.
Remind us of the core finding again.
The court found that while IEPA bestows significant authority on the president, in response to a declared national emergency, none of those actions explicitly include the power to impose tariffs, duties, or the like, or the power to tax.
So it's a monumental legal challenge striking at the heart of the America First trade agenda, directly questioning the legal basis.
Exactly. And as we said, the administration has asked the Supreme Court to review the case, requesting a decision on whether to even take it up by September 10th.
And if the Supreme Court upholds the lower court's ruling?
It could invalidate billions in tariffs and fundamentally restore a significant degree of authority over trade policy from the president back to Congress.
Profoundly highlighting that constitutional division of power in economic policy. Has the executive overstepped its bounds into areas traditionally reserved for the legislature? That's the fight.
A huge constitutional and economic battle line's being drawn.
Okay, finally, in this judicial section, a case with major implications for academic freedom. A federal court sided with Harvard University in its dispute with the administration over billions in federal research funding.
Yes. On September 3rd, U.S. District Judge Allison D. Burroughs of Boston ruled that the Trump administration's termination of about $2.6 billion in federal research grants to Harvard was unlawful.
Unlawful? Why?
She found the administration's actions amounted to illegal retaliation for Harvard's refusal to submit to White House demands for sweeping changes to its governance, policies, and admissions.
Retaliation? That's a strong finding.
It is. In her ruling, Judge Burroughs wrote that the administration had used allegations of anti-Semitism on campus, a serious issue in itself, but used them as a smokescreen for a targeted, ideologically motivated assault on this country's premier universities.
Wow, a smokescreen.
Yes. She concluded the government's actions violated Harvard's First Amendment rights, placed unconstitutional conditions on receiving federal funds, and failed to follow congressionally mandated procedures under the Administrative Procedure Act and Title VI of the Higher Education Act.
So, a very strong rebuke on multiple legal grounds. What's the practical impact here?
Well, this ruling establishes a strong legal precedent against the executive branch using the power of the federal funding to coerce ideological changes at private institutions.
It affirms principles of academic freedom and institutional autonomy,
sending a clear message that federal funding cannot be leveraged simply to dictate internal university policies based on ideology. Now, the administration has stated it will appeal this decision, so this battle isn't over either.
But for you, the listener, this is really about ensuring intellectual independence and preventing government overreach into education, protecting the integrity of higher learning institutions crucial to our nation's intellectual capital.
A fundamental principle at stake.
All right, so while the executive and judicial branches are clashing, Congress has returned from its August recess.
And they face an immediate fiscal crisis.
Mm-hmm.
The urgent need to fund the federal government beyond the end of the fiscal year, which is September 30th, 2025.
They have approximately 28 days, less than a month, to pass the 12 annual appropriations bills.
Or, more realistically, they'll likely need a continuing resolution, a CR, just to extend current funding levels and avert a government shutdown.
Given the intense political climate, the extremely short time frame, there's very little chance all 12 individual spending bills will be enacted by October 1st.
Almost zero chance, meaning at least one CR will be absolutely necessary to avoid a lapse in funding and keep the government operating.
And analysts widely believe a shutdown remains the most probable outcome.
Unfortunately, yes. Though even if one is avoided, the government is expected to operate under a series of short-term CRs, potentially extending well into December 2025.
And the legislative process is expected to be particularly contentious around which bill?
The Labor, Health, and Human Services and Education Appropriations Bill, LHHS. That one is historically a flashpoint for partisan disagreements.
Why is that one so contentious?
Well, it's often the most controversial of the spending bills. It serves as a primary vehicle for partisan fights over social policy. And this year, specifically, the administration's agenda on issues like DEI and gender ideology will likely be central to the fight over this bill.
So that deep ideological clash makes compromise exceptionally difficult, significantly heightening the risk of a shutdown.
Absolutely. It really begs the question about the functionality of Congress itself and the potential impact of a shutdown on federal services that affect you directly, from national parks closing to delays in federal payments, federal employee furloughs, disruption of critical government programs.
A shutdown has real-world consequences for everyone. #TagB, legislative proposals and committee hearings. Now, while appropriations are dominating the floor schedule, committee work has resumed.
Yes. With a flurry of new bills being introduced and hearings being held, this activity showcases that dual track of the 119th Congress we talked about.
Areas of potential bipartisan cooperation, alongside that deep-seated partisan conflict that continues to define much of the legislative agenda.
Exactly. On September 3rd, for instance, numerous new legislative proposals were introduced.
Among the most notable, maybe, is HB 5106.
Right, a bipartisan bill aimed at prohibiting members of Congress, their spouses, and their dependents from owning or trading individual stocks.
And it's sponsored by a really diverse ideological coalition. Representative Chip Roy, a conservative Republican, Seth Magaziner, a Democrat, Pramila Jayapal, a progressive Democrat, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, also a progressive Democrat.
That broad base of support is the key insight here. It indicates strong momentum for congressional ethics reform, which certainly resonates with you, the public, addressing concerns about potential conflicts of interest and basic fairness.
But other bills introduced the same day starkly reflect that partisan divide.
Yes, like HB 2502 and HB 5121, which would require parental consent for gender transitions in schools, and HB 5113, which would increase criminal penalties for assaulting Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ACE, officers.
These latter proposals are central to the Republican Party's cultural and immigration agenda.
And highly unlikely to gain any significant Democratic support, highlighting those deep ideological chasms within Congress that make major legislative compromise so difficult.
We also saw SB 2698 introduced,
aiming to reinstate post-9/11 educational assistance for victims of sexual assault.
And HB 5104, which would establish a national integrated heat health information system.
So for you, this mix of bills shows Congress is still grappling with a wide range of issues: ethics, social policy, public health, even amidst its internal divisions and the looming funding fight.
Okay, also on September 3rd, there were committee hearings. The House Energy and Commerce Subcommittee on Health held one on AI.
Yes, titled Examining Opportunities to Advance American Healthcare Through the Use of Artificial Intelligence Technologies.
And the hearing explored the transformative potential of AI in healthcare.
Right. Testimony highlighted current and future applications, improving scientific research, speeding up clinical trials, reducing administrative burdens for providers, empowering patients.
But witnesses also emphasized the significant policy challenges that need to be addressed to realize these benefits safely and ethically.
Absolutely. Key recommendations included the need for a clear federal regulatory framework, prioritizing transparency and risk mitigation. The passage of a national data privacy law came up frequently.
Modifications to reimbursement policies to actually support the adoption of effective AI tools.
Yes, and reforms to the FDA's statutory framework to make it a more constructive partner in AI development rather than just a gatekeeper.
So this indicates Congress is mainly in an educational information gathering phase on AI and healthcare.
It seems so, rather than immediately legislating, which is probably a prudent approach for such a complex and rapidly evolving field.
And looking wider, this is a crucial step. Understanding AI's complex applications and risks before attempting to regulate it. This careful approach will ultimately impact the future of your healthcare, ensuring innovation proceeds responsibly.
Hopefully.
Also on September 3rd, the Senate Special Committee on Aging held a hearing.
Yes, titled Protecting Older Americans, Leveling the Playing Field for Older Workers, led by ranking member Kirsten Gillibrand. The focus was squarely on that persistent, often overlooked problem of age discrimination in the workplace.
Witnesses, including Nancy Lehman from AARP, testified that a large majority of older workers have either seen or personally experienced age discrimination.
And they highlighted the growing economic pressures that necessitate longer working lives for many Americans. But a key theme that emerged was the insidious emerging threat of algorithmic bias in hiring.
Algorithmic bias, how does that connect to age discrimination?
Well, this is where AI-powered hiring tools can automatically screen out older applicants by using proxies for age, things like graduation dates or total years of experience listed on a resume.
Ah, so it's a hidden form of discrimination, potentially operating without human awareness. Difficult to detect and challenge.
Very difficult. Witnesses, including the journalist Gretchen Carlson, urged Congress to pass the Bipartisan Protecting Older Americans Act.
What would that act do?
It would invalidate forced arbitration clauses in age discrimination claims, allowing victims to have their cases actually heard in court rather than being forced into private arbitration behind closed doors.
What really stands out here is how this hearing directly connected the issue of AI bias to the economic security of a key and growing demographic,
showcasing how new technologies can inadvertently perpetuate old forms of discrimination. It's a critical intersection of technology and social justice, revealing unexpected challenges.
It really begs the question, How do we ensure fair employment opportunities in an increasingly automated world for all workers, regardless of age?
And how can policy truly keep pace with these rapid technological advancements to effectively protect against new, often hidden forms of bias? This is a challenge that will impact a significant portion of the workforce, and it's only going to grow. #TagTag6. Synthesis and forward outlook.
Okay, let's try and synthesize all of this. This intense week has truly revealed a U.S. federal government operating in a state of, well, high tension.
Definitely. We've seen an assertive executive branch, a judiciary acting as a formidable constitutional check, and a legislature facing immediate fiscal deadlines amidst deep polarization.
And as we've said, these aren't isolated events. They are deeply interconnected, forming a complex web of actions and reactions.
What truly stands out is that clear feedback loop we're witnessing. The administration's aggressive use of executive authority is consistently met with forceful resistance from the judiciary.
This legal conflict, playing out across issues from immigration to trade, it's not just procedural, is it?
No, it feels like a fundamental battle over the separation of powers. And the administration's response to these setbacks and to unfavorable economic data has often been to attack the perceived legitimacy of the institutions themselves.
Whether it's the courts, the civil service, or even the government's own statistical agencies like the BLS.
Exactly. And this, in turn, just fuels further political polarization and institutional distrust, creating a cycle of escalating tension.
The unfolding economic slowdown, as we discussed, seems inextricably linked to the administration's signature policies.
Right. The tariff regime, designed to foster a manufacturing renaissance, is now paradoxically seen as a primary driver of that sector's decline.
Restrictive immigration policies are tightening the labor supply.
While the public discrediting of the Bureau of Labor Statistics injects that dangerous level of uncertainty into economic forecasting and policymaking, significantly complicating the Federal Reserve's ability to respond effectively and impartially.
And similarly, the administration's hardline foreign policy doctrine redefining drug trafficking as narco-terrorism is directly connected to its domestic immigration agenda.
By framing the activities of transnational criminal organizations as a military threat to the homeland, the administration builds a justification for more aggressive military-style responses, both abroad and at the border.
Further blurring the lines between law enforcement and national defense.
So for you, the listener, this demonstrates how seemingly distinct policy areas are converging, creating a complex and volatile governance environment where actions in one sphere have profound ripple effects in others, reshaping the very nature of government functions. #TagTagB, key indicators to watch.
So looking ahead to the coming weeks and months, what are the most critical factors, the indicators that will shape the trajectory of U.S. policy and politics?
These are the key things we'll be watching very closely. First, the Federal Reserve's September meeting on the 16th and 17th.
Their decision on interest rates and the rationale they provide will be the most immediate signal of how policymakers are weighing recession risks against inflation and that significant political pressure.
And that decision will directly impact your financial landscape, borrowing costs, investment returns.
Second, keep a very close eye on the September 30th government funding deadline.
Whether Congress can agree on a continuing resolution to avoid a shutdown, and for how long, will be a key barometer of legislative functionality and partisan brinkmanship.
And a shutdown could directly affect federal services you rely on.
Third, we'll be watching for Supreme Court actions, specifically their decisions on whether to even hear the administration's appeals in those landmark cases concerning tariff authority, the Alien Enemies Act, and the domestic use of the military.
Those decisions will set the stage for a constitutional reckoning over the scope of presidential power, with huge implications for checks and balances.
And fourth, the September jobs report, which is due out in early October. That will be absolutely critical.
To determine whether the weakness in the August data was just an anomaly, a blip, or confirmation of a sustained economic downturn.
It will directly influence economic forecasts and future policy responses. These are the pressure points. They'll significantly influence the immediate future, giving us a clearer picture of what lies ahead. #TagTagCheck future scenarios.
Based on these indicators, looking at the wider context, can we envision some primary scenarios for the final quarter of 2025?
We can outline a few possibilities, each carrying profound implications for you.
Okay, what's scenario one?
Economic stagflation and political gridlock. In this scenario, the Fed cuts interest rates, but the economy continues to stagnate. Why? persistent policy uncertainty from the tariff regime, broader political instability.
And Congress fails to pass a long-term budget, leading to a protracted, damaging government shutdown that further erodes economic and consumer confidence.
Right. The result: a period characterized by low growth, persistent inflation driven by tariffs, and pervasive political paralysis. Not a pretty picture.
No. What's scenario two?
Constitutional crisis. In this path, the Supreme Court agrees to hear one or more of those major executive power cases we discussed,
elevating the legal battles into a full-blown constitutional crisis that dominates the political landscape.
Right. And the administration might respond to adverse rulings with defiance, further testing the limits of judicial review and the rule of law. This would create unprecedented levels of political and market uncertainty, impacting the foundational aspects of American governance and how our institutions function.
Okay. And scenario three?
Foreign policy escalation. Here, the administration, emboldened by its new narco-terrorism doctrine, conducts further kinetic strikes against designated FTOs, perhaps in Latin America,
leading to a diplomatic crisis with key regional partners who view the actions as a violation of their sovereignty.
Exactly. This scenario could potentially destabilize security cooperation, create new geopolitical tensions in the Western Hemisphere, with ripple effects on trade, regional stability, maybe even the safety of citizens abroad.
Understanding these potential paths helps you anticipate and interpret future news as it unfolds, allows you to better prepare for the implications on your daily life and broader society.
These aren't just theoretical possibilities. They are real considerations based on the trends and events we've dissected today. Hashtag tag outro.
Wow. What an intense and comprehensive look at the U.S. federal government's actions just this past week, from executive directives reshaping the civil service and immigration to a weakening economy and a judiciary actively pushing back. It's clear we're in a period of profound change and, well, significant challenges.
Indeed. This deep dive into the federal news update for Friday, September 5th, 2025, truly highlights that intricate dance between the branches of government and how quickly policies can shift with such far-reaching consequences. As we watch these interlocking narratives unfold, it really makes you ask, how much authority should any single branch wield?
And what does all this mean for the future of governance, the economy, America's place in the world? It's certainly something for you to consider deeply as these critical indicators play out in the weeks and months ahead.
Absolutely. Keep asking those big questions.
Thank you for joining us on The Deep Dive. We hope this exploration has given you a clearer understanding of the forces at play and equipped you with the insights to stay well-informed and engaged. We'll be here to help you dive even deeper next time.